welcome to Hashtag No Limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino, and Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but whom are busting through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is not a better or more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells, and just when it thinks its life is over, it reforms into the butterfly. But it's not finished struggling. It has to struggle even still in the cocoon in order to make its wings strong enough to take it everywhere that it's going to soar to when it is ready. And I think that is a beautiful example. And I think that that can't be easy, but neither is busting through limits that society places upon a person. And my guest today, Dr. Emily Levy, is going to talk to us about all things special education and some wonderful books that she has written and strategies that she uses in order to help all students, no matter what their ability level is, to learn and to thrive in school and in life. But before we bring her on, I do want to remind you to please like and subscribe to this channel. You do not want to miss an episode. All of my guests have amazing stories to tell, and I just think it's amazing all the things that we do and learn about in this. So don't miss an episode. Be sure to like and subscribe. If you are watching in the live, give us a hashtag live and where you're watching from in the comments. And if you're watching in the replay, give us a hashtag replay and where you're watching from. And if you have any comments or questions, please be sure to put them in the chat, whether live or in the replay. And I will make sure live that they get up on the screen and Dr. Emily sees them right away. If you put them later, I will make sure that she gets them. All right, enough from me. Let's bring on Dr. Emily. How are you today?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, it's awesome to have you. So you and I have education in our blood. we basically eat, sleep, and breathe it. So, but before we really dive into the exact reason that you're here today, go ahead and give us a little bit of a background of who you are, a little bit of bio about yourself.
Be happy to. So I actually grew up in the field of special education. My mother was the founder of a school for students with learning disabilities down in South Florida, which is where I grew up. So I really grew up working at her school, being trained in different methods, working with special education students. But after going to Brown for college, I, of all things, went into finance. I kind of didn't want to follow in my mother's time. So I did finance for 2 years, quickly realized it wasn't my calling, although I did learn a lot. It was a great experience. But I just remembered how gratifying it was working with children, especially those with special education needs. So I pivoted and I ended up receiving my master's degree in special education, as well as my doctorate degree in general education. And I started out personally working one-on-one with students who had various types of special education needs. And just eventually from there, slowly and organically grew the program into EBL coaching, where we now serve students worldwide by providing one-on-one tutoring using all research-based multisensory techniques that are catered to the needs of each student.
That is awesome. So since you mentioned the website, I want to go ahead and bring that up and just have you talk about that a little bit. How do people get a hold of you? What does EBL coaching offer them exactly? And just all of that wonderful information.
Great. And thank you for bringing up our website. So at EBL Coaching, we specialize in providing one-on-one tutoring to students with special education needs as young as the preschool level and all the way through the adult level in all core academic skill areas, reading, spelling, writing, math, and executive functioning skills, all very much catered to the needs of each student. So we begin with an initial assessment to gauge their needs. We review any IEPs or other evaluations that they may have. And then we come up with an individualized plan of instruction. And we provide both in-person tutoring in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area. And then we do virtual tutoring one-on-one with students actually worldwide now. We have students in Asia and Europe, really all over the world, which has been very exciting. And on the website, there's also also a lot of resources for parents. I'm such a believer in parents learning information, trying to just gather as much as they can so that they too can help their child. So there's lots of articles that I've written, different podcasts that I've been on. There's information about the workbooks that I've written. Some parents like to kind of buy those and keep those at home to use with their students. So just a nice resource of lots of information for parents to use.
Yes, this is awesome. As I am looking through it, executive functioning skills right now seems to be quite the hot topic. Can you discuss a little bit about executive functioning skills, please?
Sure, be happy to. You know, it's funny because these are challenges I think that kids and adults have had for many, many years, but the term executive functioning has sort of become this buzzword term, you know, in the past several years. But executive functioning basically involves skills like planning, organization, time management, task initiation. Many students struggle with executive functioning. And when they show weaknesses in those skills, it can really negatively affect their performance across the board academically. So they might be really bright and really strong with academic content, but if they have poor executive functioning skills, it really can prevent them from doing well in school.
Yes, absolutely. And there is just so much, it seems like you said, it's been around for a long time, but it just seems to be in the last, like, I don't know, 10 or so years that it's really become the coined term. And people seem to be talking about it a lot more as far as what you mentioned, you know, just being able to rely on strategies, develop skills to understand the world around us. And I know there's lots of people that I've spoken to that have talked about executive functioning. And I'm curious to know your thoughts between, a lot of people have said that the executive functioning skills are very similar to ADHD. And that maybe a lot of people who have been diagnosed with ADHD are actually maybe somebody with executive functioning skills deficits. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think they definitely go hand in hand. I think that almost every ADHD student I've met also struggles with executive functioning. So they very much go hand in hand. Typically with ADHD, there's not only a challenge with staying focused and on task, but these individuals tend to struggle again with organization, planning, time management, all of these core executive functioning skills. So I would say without a doubt, they definitely go hand in hand.
Yeah, thanks. So is there any space? I know we talked about your workbooks. We talked about your articles. I'm going to pop over here to the As Seen on TV. So you want to talk about that a little bit, where what you've been on television and kind of I see a lot of these are also podcasts. So is there any specific thing that you want to talk about or that you are exceptionally proud of because you were part of that programming?
Sure. So I have been guest on several different podcasts and some TV segments, as you mentioned. Really, what I love at the end of the day is educating parents. And that's what most of my podcasts that I'm a guest for are about, are strategies and tools that parents can use with their children to help advocate for them and to help them really feel confident and successful in school. So that's what a lot of my podcasts are about. And again, I just think it's a great way to spread awareness and really educate parents.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the main reasons that I do hashtag no limits is to try to bring awareness, because I feel as though it happened to me. And so I just figure, well, it must happen to other people too. I can't be the only one that this has happened to, that when my exposure to people who learned differently than myself or who were truly eligible for special education, that's when my perspective changed about the people that fall into those categories and their ability levels and their life goals. And, you know, just realizing that, hey, this is still a person first. Mm. And you know, most is that this is a person. And so to focus on a specific disability or eligibility for special education and say that that's the main component of a person, that's the idea of where this came from, was I don't like that, because I feel like I had the erroneous idea growing up. Nobody taught me to think that way, but I shouldn't say nobody. I should say society and the school system sort of taught me to think that way. And my parents didn't intentionally teach me differently. I realized growing up that I had, you know, when I was growing up, the special education law was just first coming into existence. And so a lot of places didn't know what to do with the students. And so they stuck them in a corner closet room, you know, down a hall that nobody went very often. They weren't mainstreamed with us in the general education population. And so I did get this sense of division. And while my family were very inclusive and we had, you know, we never said no to, my parents didn't know strangers, anybody and everybody was welcome at our house, but they didn't intentionally and directly teach me, hey, just because somebody's different, that's not less than or wrong. And so I just kind of gleaned that from society by the way I saw the students being treated at school and society if I did happen to see them out in public.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm done.
I completely agree with you wholeheartedly. And, you know, something I always tell parents when it comes up is that so many of the greatest CEOs, celebrities, business executives in our country, in the world, have some kind of special education challenge, whether it's ADHD, dyslexia, autism, and they have come to thrive in whatever career they chose. So I think for a lot of students who are neurodivergent, getting through school is the challenge. But if we can give the right tools and support, they have the potential to be incredibly successful in life. And I've seen that firsthand.
Yes, I so love that you just said that, because I have felt that myself for years, that, you know, it's such a shame in a way that we take these little minds and we put them in this institution of school when they're little, and then we mold them to think, well, if you're not successful here, you're not going to be successful in life. Mm-hmm. And that's so not the truth, for exactly what you just said. And I wish there was, you know, some other way to go about educating people, because it just seems such a harsh way to do it. That there's, I'm like you, I have seen so many people who have been told by society, or specifically by individuals or medical professionals or educators, well, you're not going to be successful in life because, you know, you're not on grade level with your peers and you're not behaving properly and you can't do this and you won't do that. And that's kind of where it is where the idea of the title of the book came from, and the whole book idea of my book, Those Who Can't Teach, because I wanted to show these families that allowed me to interview them, but all the other families that I knew that I saw, again, they're people first. Mm-hmm. They have wants, they have desires, they laugh, they cry, they get mad. I mean, everything that I do. And so trying to share that out, that these people are successful. And unfortunately, we've just put them in this box early on in their life and said, oh, well, from this lens, you're not going to be successful.
Yeah. It's a shame. And I think it crushes these kids, that so many of them have such poor self-confidence, anxiety, depression. And, you know, one little tool that I like to share with parents is that everyone has a gift. Everyone has strengths and weaknesses, but even the most challenged child has strengths. And I encourage parents to play up those strengths. So if their child really struggles with reading, but they're great at art, sign them up for art classes. Encourage that skill. Yes. If they're great at acting or building Legos or whatever it may be, build that skill, because it's something they'll feel good about. Even if they struggle in school, well, they'll have something to kind of hold on to that makes them feel good and that they're really good at.
Right. And we have done a real disservice, I think, in our education system by pulling music and arts and, you know, hands-on type of classes once kids get into high school, because we have felt that we have this, you know, they just need more academics, you know, and they just we're falling behind. And so we need to push this and push this, and we're pushing it younger and younger. Yeah. And it frustrates me. Emily, honestly, because there are people making these decisions about what needs to go into these curriculums that really don't seem to understand childhood development and brain development, and what are better ways to learn than just sitting in a classroom at a desk for 8 hours a day. I mean, I know no student does that literally, but you know, that's the general concept is you sit and you hear a lecture and you learn.
Exactly. And to your point, these other non-academic skills are really just as important in many respects as the academic one. So I completely agree with you on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, just the, like you said, the creative minds that, you know, the ones who, yes, there's a large portion of the population that learns through academics and, you know, just that kind of the way that school is set up, but the being creative, the allowing our students, how do you feel about this? Allowing our students to fail or make mistakes as part of the learning process and not being punished for that with a big F across the paper or, you know, a bunch of red marks across the paper, but as a learning tool.
Great question. I believe that the younger kids experience failure, the more likely they'll be to be successful in life. I think if we coddle them and we don't allow them to fail and learn from their failure, inevitably they're going to enter the workforce or enter life and experience failure and have to deal with it then. But if they can experience that younger, when the consequences are not as great, when they have a support system in place, I think that will help set them up for success in life.
Yeah, I think so too. And I feel like we let our daughter fail sometimes, but also at the same time, I was a teacher. So I was always poor thing teaching her something. So hopefully, hopefully I didn't do her a disservice by, you know, okay, well, you made this mistake. So how can we learn from this mistake? You know, and she just, thankfully she was, you know, academically sound and didn't struggle a lot, but because she had been so successful early on, when she did actually start to struggle, that was huge for her. I mean, like she felt like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm all of a sudden I'm dumb. I don't know what happened. I don't know how to do this. And we worked for a while on teaching her, you're not dumb. You just actually finally are having to learn material and put some energy and effort into it where you never had to prior to this.
Right. And it happens to everyone. It's really, in a way, a matter of timing. Does it happen when you're younger or does it happen when you're older, when the stakes are that much higher? So it's right. Something that we're all going to experience. And I believe the younger kids can experience it without being crushed, of course, that the better it is for them ultimately.
Yeah. And when we're talking about failures, we're not talking about constant and consistent failures, or at least I'm not.
Right. Correct.
Yeah. So can you talk to that a little bit about the difference between, like, you know, every day constantly failing at school and, you know, cause again, that's the majority of a kid's life is school versus occasional failures. And then how to help teach them through that failure. Cause I feel like the programs that I've read that you've developed, I have a feeling those components are in there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that if a child is showing consistent patterns of failure, for example, they're showing up to class late every single day and every day they're turning in assignments late. Well, that's an issue. We need to work on that. We need to work on time management. We need to work on organization and we need to work on stopping that from happening every day. If there's one time when a child just blanked and forgot to turn in their assignment and got an F on that, well, let's take that as a teaching tool. Let's learn from that. It's okay. It happened one time. What can we do differently going forward? But it's not a consistent pattern. It's not something that's happening on a regular basis. So I think it's kind of analyzing the big picture. Is it something that's happening regularly and therefore we need to work on strategies for it? Or is it a one-off failure kind of situation that we can just talk about and move on from?
Right. And you have a 22-part student workbook series called Strategies for Study Success. And I think what we were just talking about blends nicely into talking about that. Would you share some of those strategies and techniques and kind of why you developed it and how it was developed?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So that workbook series teaches students concrete research-based strategies for executive functioning skills alike, planning, organization, time management, task initiation, summarizing, sequencing, all of these skills that are so important for success in school. And the reason why I developed that series really was because I couldn't find anything out there that not just taught students concrete strategies in a way that was easy for them to understand, but also gave them a lot of practice applying those strategies. So in the workbooks, students are taught a strategy. For example, one strategy for time management is let's predict how much time we think a task is going to take and note the ET or the estimated time, and then compare it to how much time it actually takes, which is the AT. So we're looking at the ET versus the AT. And in the workbook, we simulated exercises. Let's sharpen 9 pencils. How long do we think that's going to take? How long does it actually take? Let's read 1 chapter in a book. How long do we think it's going to take? How long does it actually take? And then once students grasp the strategy, then we can show them how to apply it to their relevant schoolwork. So it's a matter of teaching the strategy, giving them practice with it, and then showing them how to apply those tools to their schoolwork. So very concrete, lots of practice, easy to follow.
And I think it's interesting because I could see that almost being like a game or a competition mindset of, okay, this is how much time I think it's going to take. And then how much time was the actual amount? And then maybe going, okay, well, can we, so we estimated that it wasn't going to take as long. Is there a way to make the actual time faster so that our estimate is closer? So I could see kids that have a little bit of a competitive nature, which would have been me, against myself. I was never really competitive against others, but I was always pushing myself to do better. And honestly, the idea is probably from the fact that when I get a direction to go somewhere and my GPS tells me my estimated time of arrival, I read that as my time to beat. Right. So
yes,
maybe that's why I'm seeing this as a competition.
Yeah, well, you're right. It is. They kind of have fun with it. And ultimately, at the end of the day, usually those times do start to merge and they become much more realistic with their time, where the estimated time is starting to match the actual time. So it really builds those key time management skills.
Yeah. So what other skills? So I see that you, the flags and stars, Orton Gillingham. So can you tell us what Orton Gillingham is and then the specific part about the flags and stars?
Absolutely. The Orton Gillingham method is a specific research-based multisensory technique that's designed to help students develop their decoding and encoding skills, or essentially their reading and spelling skills. And it's very sequential, very multisensory. So initially, we start out by teaching students the names of the letters and their corresponding sounds, how to blend basic 2 and 3 sounds together to form words. And then we build from there. We move on to words containing blends and consonant digraphs, vowel digraphs, multisyllabic word patterns, and so on. So we use this multisensory approach. We start with the foundations and then build upwards from there to help students develop those core foundational reading and spelling skills.
Thank you. With those skills, who do they best support? Who do they best serve?
Well, the Orton Gillingham methodology was originally designed for students with dyslexia, students who really had a fundamental challenge with learning how to read and spell. But over time, we found that it's a method that all students can benefit from and all students really enjoy because it's so multisensory. We integrate tools like colored sand, magnetic tiles, mini whiteboards, learning games. So it really helps to engage the kids while at the same time developing those core skills.
Yes, and that happens so often when something is developed for a small population and then it turns out to be beneficial to a much larger population. And Orton Gillingham is definitely one of those. And with the Orton Gillingham, I believe that only goes to a certain age or grade level. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. So, at a certain point, students start to, or schools and teachers start to focus more on, instead of learning to read, reading to learn. So there becomes more of an emphasis on reading comprehension and writing, usually starting in about 4th grade, give or take. With that said, we've worked with many students who are in high school and still don't have intact phonics skills and really need those back to basics, fundamentals. They need that Orton-Gillingham instruction to build more of the core, the mechanics of reading and writing before they can even start to tackle reading for understanding and for meaning. So I think it's more about the level of the student than what grade they're in or how old they are.
Okay, that makes sense to me. So when I was growing up, as I said earlier, you know, it was the beginning of the special education law. So it was back in the 1900s. And I can remember that we had things called the letter people, and we had little booklets, and they had little, I think they had like little videos. I mean, there was no YouTube at that time, but I feel like there were little, you know, TV programs that we watched, and they had little songs. And then we also had, there was another thing that I can't think of the name of it, but, I feel like when in the 70s that we did a lot of phonemic awareness and phonics knowledge, and then kind of around the 90s, maybe late 80s, 90s, we kind of went to this whole language approach. And then now here we are in the 2020s, kind of looking back and going back towards the phonemic awareness. Is that a, am I kind of remembering this correctly?
Yes, I would say so. I think over the years, there always seems to be this pivot from teaching phonics to shifting to whole language to back to phonics. And at the end of the day, students need to learn how to decode words. They really need those phonic skills. For them to learn how to read by looking at context clues only or pictures from a book, they're really not efficiently learning how to read. So yes, now we're in this wave where we're sort of back to phonics and phonemic awareness. I hope it stays that way. I think kids really need to learn those skills, but I guess time will tell.
Right. And we have, I mean, as the years have gone on, we get more and more knowledge about how the brain works and you know, how those synapses are made and what connects when, where, and we have much more understanding of brain development. And I know, like, with those, going back a little bit in our discussion to the executive functioning skills, those, I have a graphic that I use that talks about that and how we often are requiring kids to do things that they really haven't, their brain more than likely hasn't developed yet. And, you know, and I think that's another area where we have the knowledge base now. And are you starting to see in your work with schools the shift of, okay, now we do have this knowledge and we do need to change how we're doing things as far as instruction and reading and math and behavior and the structure of classrooms?
Yes, I think it is starting to change. I think it's completely district by district, school by school. I would say I've seen it the most with reading. I think there's much more of an emphasis now on the science of reading. Again, phonemic awareness, phonics, really those fundamental skills. But I think in general, we are learning more. There's more research about what's effective in terms of teaching. So yes, I would say the general trend seems to be more effective, more evidence-based teaching methods.
Yeah. And I believe we did this, but just to make sure that, you know, because we're throwing out words like phonemic awareness and phonemes. Would you describe those, please, in case there is someone in the audience who doesn't know or that we didn't explain it well enough previously?
Sure. So phonemic awareness is more kind of the precursor skills to reading. Things like rhyming, identifying sounds that correspond with letters, identifying, for instance, the beginning sound in a word or the ending sound in a word. So sort of these precursor to reading types of skills. Phonemes are essentially sounds. So we once students have developed their phonemic awareness skills, we can then move into phonics and individual letters, sounds, blending, reading, spelling, that kind of thing.
Awesome. Thank you for that.
Sure.
So let's talk about your math strategies, because I know we've been talking about a lot about reading. And I know that reading is, again, I'm going back to my childhood, reading is fundamental. Riff, I remember. Yep. And so, of course, yes, reading is the foundation. You know, you're not going to be able to do most of anything if you don't have a good, solid reading base. But math is so important, and we do that in everyday life. So what are some of the math strategies that you have written about and that your books cover that you can share with us today?
Sure. Well, you know, we've had a lot of kids come to us that are in, for instance, seventh or eighth grade, and their parent says that they're really struggling with algebra. They just can't get through it. And when I evaluate them, I see that they're lacking these early foundational skills in addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and so on. And without those foundational skills, it's almost impossible to excel at algebra. So what I sought to do was really, I was trying to find materials that I felt effectively developed those core foundational math skills in a multisensory way. And I really struggled to find that. So that's why I created my own. And so it's a multi-part workbook series that teaches students in a multisensory way with lots of these visual, tactile manipulatives that go along with it, but core skills in understanding numbers, addition, subtraction, double-digit addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, double-digit multiplication and division, and then fractions. So it really helps students develop these foundational skills so that when they're asked to tackle these more complex concepts, they're now able to do so because they have those core skills intact.
Yes, thank you. So when you're saying that it's multi-sensory or multi-modalities, again, I just try to think if there's somebody watching or listening that doesn't know what those mean, or they think they know what those mean, but they're not quite sure. Could you go ahead and describe what those are for me, please?
Sure. So multi-sensory means that rather than focusing on one modality or just say working out of a workbook or listening to a teacher, we integrate multiple modalities simultaneously, the visual, the auditory, and the tactile kinesthetic modalities. That involves tools like magnetic tiles, colored sand, multicolored highlighters, base 10 blocks. Sometimes we use Play-Doh for forming balls, for counting. So these kinds of concrete tools that students can see, they can feel, they can touch, and that really helps for information to stick in their long-term memory.
And why does that work better?
There's been a lot of research that supports specifically for students who have learning challenges that kind of multisensory approach, again, helps information to sort of retain, to stick in their long-term memory. But like I said before, over time, we found that it's a great method that pretty much every single student can benefit from.
Yeah, I can remember when I was in the classroom full time, and I would have a time in our day called buddy time. And we would have some of our gen ed peers come in, and they would just play and interact with my students. But I always made sure, and it took a lot of work, but I designed the activities to go with the students' IEP goals and objectives. Mm-hmm. And so we used shaving cream. We had Play-Doh. We danced. We played board games. We had all kinds of different manipulatives for, you know, if we were stringing beads, then we were counting, you know, or we were talking about the shapes, or we were, coming up with different, story starters, or, you know, just lots of different things in order to have that socialization piece, but also have those different modalities. And my room, I had, I think, like 75 different activities that we included during that, what I called buddy time. I didn't realize there was a national program out at the time called Buddies. So I hope I didn't, I wasn't trying to infringe. I did not know they were out there. but yeah, I mean, it's so important that, you know, I think it's, what is the research? The more senses that you can involve, which is the multisensory, the more apt the person is to not just learn it, but be able to retain it and also to teach it to other people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you had all those tools in your classroom.
I was very blessed. I worked very closely with OTs, PTs, and speech therapists, and they helped me figure out what would be good things for my students to work with and work on. And again, trying to follow those IEP goals. And it did have the unique side effect of when I started the program, I had about 25, maybe percent of the students that I asked that volunteered. And after a couple of years, I was at 100% of 6th, 7th, and 8th graders volunteering to be part of that program. So it was a very good program. And still to this day, I will have students that were the big buddies will see me out in public and they still know who I am. And it's been 15 years And they'll ask me, you know, do you still keep in contact with such and such students, or, you know, or I saw so-and-so student and, you know, they look great. And so, yeah, it was a great experience. And it really helped lessen the stigma about special education as well, which was another unexpected side effect.
A very important one. It's great.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So, so I'm going to put up, I was putting it up while we were talking, but I just want to make sure to say them out loud. Your website, which I know we showed earlier, but it is eblcoaching.com. So E as in everyone, B as in boy, L as in love. And I presume those are your initials.
They're my initials. And it also stands for evidence-based learning.
Oh, how perfect is that?
There.
And then, if anybody wants to find you on LinkedIn, they can just look you up under Emily Levy. And am I saying it right?
Yes, you are. Not many people get it right the first try, but you are.
Okay. Yes. And then, yeah, Instagram is just Instagram.com/EBL_coaching. Facebook is the same thing, /EBL coaching. And then if they want to get a hold of you, where did I put your email? There it is. It is ELEVY or E Levy at EBLcoaching.com. And so you said earlier that you are internationally tutoring now. And so what kind of differences have you seen from your international students to your students from the United States?
You know, of course, it varies from student to student, country to country. But I think at the end of the day, a child that has dyslexia, whether they're living in England or Asia or New York, they show the same kinds of challenges and they still benefit from the Orton-Gillingham method, from the same kind of approach. So they really can be from anywhere, living anywhere, and show the same kinds of challenges.
I love that because to me, what that proves is that it is real.
Yeah.
I mean, we have so many people who dismiss so many disabilities and they just say, well, you know, they're faking it or they're just making it up to get attention or whatever. And to have students that are from multiple places around the world exhibiting the same characteristics and then benefiting from the same types of service just proves both things, that both it's real and that these interventions are solid.
Absolutely. Completely agree.
So how do we, now that I've said that and these interventions being solid, how do we get them in all the schools?
Oh, the million-dollar question. If only we had the answer to that.
Right.
I think that to start, having really good professional development is so important, where teachers are learning these concrete systematic approaches for how to teach reading or math or whatever the skill may be, with practice and oversight, because I think that's really key, is having the right evidence-based interventions within the classroom to prevent a lot of challenges that kids may have down the road as they move through school.
And how do you feel that our universities here in the United States are preparing our new teachers? Do you feel it's good enough? Does it need a lot of work? Is it okay?
I think from what I've seen, there's a lot of great teaching on the philosophy behind teaching, on pedagogy, but I think personally that there needs to be more concrete instruction on strategies for how to teach different types of learners, more of these, again, these evidence-based techniques built into the teaching of teachers.
I 100% agree with you. I get so frustrated because we get these new teachers and I, like yourself, provide professional development to teachers. And especially now when we have had, you know, so many teachers leaving education. And so we're trying to fill in the gaps that are left and we're certifying people in very different ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been lots of creative ways to certify people.
Yes.
And we're still giving them, like you said, the philosophy and the pedagogy. And I think we're wasting time when we could be doing a much better job of preparing our teachers before they get there of how to teach. I really believed for myself that it was a lot of on-the-job training.
Yeah.
I felt like I was lacking so much when I got into the classroom. And I was kind of a late bloomer as far as getting my degree. I worked as a paraprofessional for several years and as a substitute, we lived overseas and I was able to substitute with just my associate's degree. Mm-hmm. And so I had a lot of substituting years, and I just, even with all of that experience, what they gave me in college was just, if I hadn't had those other experiences, I don't think I would have been as strong a first year teacher as I actually was, because I had picked up a lot of knowledge from my experiences, not from what I learned in my classrooms.
Yep, as is often the case. And that may even be part of why so many teachers are leaving. I think a lot of them feel so overwhelmed when they enter the classroom and they're not prepared for how to teach these different kinds of students. So I think if they can learn that when they're being taught, I think that can make a difference.
I think that's absolutely true, because there are so many teachers that, you know, if you're getting a general education teaching degree, you're getting out of 120-ish credit hours to get that four-year degree, you're getting 3 to 6 of those hours that are required to learn about special education.
Yep.
And that's it. But yet we have a law that says, rightly so in my thinking, that everyone should be educated in the least restrictive environment, and a group of people determine that the general education classroom is the least restrictive environment for a multitude of our students, and yet we haven't trained our teachers to work with those who just like you said, they learn different. And absolutely, we're getting, you know, I mean, what's the, even before the last, you know, since the pandemic, I mean, I think the teacher turnover rate was 7 years for general ed and like 3 to 5 years for special education teachers.
Yeah.
And I don't know who to talk to or how to make it change, but I do think that is a definite problem in our teacher gap. I don't think it's a teacher shortage. We have thousands of people certified as teachers, but we didn't provide them the proper support. We didn't provide them the proper respect. We didn't provide them the proper training. Mm-hmm. And then they left because their mental health, rightly so, again, in my opinion, was more important than all the struggles that they were facing in their classrooms.
Yeah, completely agree.
Do you offer, I know you offer the online tutoring for students, but do you offer any kind of professional development online for educators?
We don't. It's something that's in the pipeline, something that I've thought about doing down the road. But at the moment, our specialty more is one-on-one work with kids.
Right. And there are trainings out there for, I mean, Orton Gillingham does a fabulous job of giving that training. And I provide professional development. And, you know, so, I mean, there's probably a couple thousand, if not more, people out there providing professional development. So we just have about 10 or so minutes. And I just want to make sure that we have covered and talked about all the things that you had hoped to cover and talk about when you agreed to be my guest. And if not, now's we've got, like I said, we've got 10 or so minutes that we can cover more stuff if you want to.
You know, I think this has been such a great, interesting conversation. I think we've covered a lot of material. I can't really think of anything else that I was hoping to speak about that we didn't cover. But I think we really covered a lot of ground in this conversation.
All right. So what's next for Dr. Emily Levy? What's coming? I mean, I know you said possible PD on the pipeline, but what else?
Well, I'm also working on a software program to help students improve their writing skills. It uses evidence-based approaches specifically for writing, where it has built-in programming. Students take a baseline writing assessment, and then it's programmed to analyze the student's writing and then start them on the appropriate level that's write for them, whether it's sentence structure, simple paragraphs, extended paragraphs, five paragraph essays. So that's something that's been an exciting project for me that I've been working on, always looking to expand our reach to help kids in different geographic areas that may not have access to the kind of evidence-based tutoring that we provide. So always open to new opportunities, always growing and evolving and trying to help as many kids as we can.
So that just triggered a thought in my head. Are you looking for educators? And are the people who do the tutoring certified teachers, or what is their background? And are you looking for educators to help?
Yeah, I mean, most of them are. Right now, we're not. We're pretty at full at capacity. In the fall, we may be looking to bring on new individuals, new educators. But right now, we have a fantastic team on board. We're looking towards planning the summer for a lot of kids who really benefit from that support and going from there.
Awesome. All right, guys. So I just want to remind you again of Dr. Emily's, her website is eblcoaching.com. You can reach her through Elevy at eblcoaching.com. And she is on LinkedIn, Facebook, and on Instagram. I thank her again for being my guest today. There is a great need. As we said, we don't feel, her and my opinion are the same in that we don't feel that our universities are preparing our teachers well enough. And so they're not able to cover everything and do everything in their classrooms. And therefore there's a need for tutoring, and she's offering this wonderful service. And reach out to her if you need online, or if you are in her area, I think it was Bronx and Queens. And I know she said they did. I'm actually going to pull her back on really quick. where are you physically located again? I'm sorry.
That's okay. Our main learning center is in Manhattan. We also have another learning center in New Jersey, and we work with kids in all of the areas surrounding Manhattan, Westchester, Connecticut, Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island, Long Island.
Okay, perfect. And I did think of another question, if you don't mind. Can I ask you one more? Do you have any sort of, we didn't talk about the price, of course, of the tutoring, but do you have any sort of scholarships or help for families that they need the tutoring, but maybe they can't afford your rate?
We do try to work with families on a case-by-case basis based on their individual needs.
Okay, perfect. I wanted to throw that out because I know there's a lot of people who need tutoring, but and they also need my services as an IEP consultant. But, need it, but can't necessarily afford at the rate. So I'm just like you. I try to work with families and make it as cost effective as possible. Okay. Well, thank you again, Emily, for being my guest this week. And guys, remember, we know who we are, but not who we will become. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykino.com, SHELLEYKENOW.